the Global Gaming Business Podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by Pavilion Payments, which empowers gaming institutions to create an enhanced patron experience with a complete suite of integrated payment solutions that enable safe, secure, and trusted cash access at the cage, on the casino floor, or online. Learn more at pavilionpayments.com. I'm Roger Gross, and my guest today is Andre Carrier, the Chief Operating Officer for Eureka Casinos. Eureka Casinos started as a small gaming hall on Sahara Avenue in Las Vegas. Later, it expanded into Mesquite, Nevada, where it's now one of the largest casinos. But the real interesting story about Eureka is how it expanded into Hampshire with its charity casinos. Chief Operating Officer Andre Carrier explains how Eureka took the Seabrook Greyhound Park and turned it into the Brook, the state's largest casino, and he also talks about how the charity casino donates millions of dollars to charitable organizations throughout the state. He also reveals how Eureka has transitioned to a completely employee-owned company and how that benefits both the company and the people who work there. He spoke with me from his offices in New Hampshire in August. Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast. My guest today is Andre Carrier, the CEO of Eureka Casinos. Andre, thanks for joining us. I'm looking forward to our discussion today. You've got some great experience in your background. Why don't we start with what Eureka Casinos is and how you wound up there?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. Sure. It's always fun to do these things with someone who's got such great history and knows so many people, so it's fun. I think I'll start with this. Eureka Casinos is the only 100% employee-owned resort casino company in America, because I think that's probably something that sets it apart, right, makes it a bit different. And it's also the owner of the largest charity casino in America, which is the Brook in Seabrook, New Hampshire. And, you know, my journey here is actually one of, friendship for sure. I came to Las Vegas more than 30 years for 3 months because a classmate and friend, asked me to stop through on my way to a job I was taking in Seattle. And the city was so kind to me, and there were so many opportunities. I never left. And I made a friend in the early days of Las Vegas, Greg Lee, and his family. It was kind of a recent addition to to the casino industry in Southern Nevada. And he and I really developed a great friendship over many years when I was working for the Loudons at Sahara Resorts, and then the incumbent company, Santa Fe. And then when I joined Mirage, to run the Golden Nugget, originally in Laughlin, and then later Las Vegas. And until I probably got to the now, I was a family office kid. I grew up in a family business. Until, you know, one day we really just wondered if we could work together and make our lives and our work lives better together. And, we made that decision long time ago now. Hey, not all friends should work together. That's the truth. Sure. We've all heard the stories where they shouldn't. for he and I, it has been, and I'm speaking for him now, but you can have him on a different show and you can see if you get it. But for he and I, it's been a tremendous blessing and journey together. And, you know, we're still in the midst of it. So that's our origin story. I was Batman, that's the origin story.
So tell me about the Nevada operations to begin with.
Yeah, so obviously the Eureka as a company, its origins start there right on Sahara, at 595 Sahara. And, there's so many great stories about Ted Lee, Mr. Lee's kind of beginnings is in first understanding that they owned a casino building. And then making the decision to get into the business backwards from an office in San Francisco, I think, at the time when he was first coming to understand that. And, you know, that's a neat legacy. Might be one of Las Vegas's first neighborhood casinos in a way, given that kind of intersection of the Las Vegas Country Club and the homes across the street are probably one of the early neighborhoods in Las Vegas. And Mr. Lee bought a parcel of property. The obviously the origin company is Urban Land. Mm-hmm. They're in the land business. Right. He bought a parcel in Mesquite many years ago, and we've grown that property now over more than 25 years, I think, into a regional leader and a golf sure. destination. Yep. And it certainly benefited from a resurgence in golf travel.
Right.
A lot of people took up the game during the pandemic, mm-hmm. And that's been terrific. And of course, Mesquite and St. George have grown substantially.
Right.
And I'm also going to say, well, they've grown well.
Right.
So quality of life continues to be enhanced mm-hmm. and advanced. And I think Mesquite's a great place to live, be it for 6 months a year, or to kind of move your life into a different place and a different pace.
Sure.
And so the community's done well, and so the business has been able to thrive.
Great, great. So you got into New Hampshire. What made you look beyond the borders of Nevada, for first of all?
Yeah. You know, shortly after making the decision to become employee-owned, we were really still come and understand that really what an ESOP is, an employee stock ownership plan, is a right. long-term retirement benefit mm-hmm. where the investment of those employees is in their own company.
Right.
And I don't think there's too many pension fund managers who would say, here's how I'm going to run your money for you folks. I'm going to have one investment in one city in one industry.
Right.
so it became pretty clear that to do this well, we needed to diversify the business. Mm-hmm. And certainly when you're thinking about how and where, you tend to think about places you know well, and one of those places is going to be home. And part of home for both Greg and I is New England. And so we kept our ear to the ground for different opportunities in a place that we knew and understood. And Seabrook Park is a place that I was in a lot during my childhood and yeah. Stopping through with uncles and godparents and parents. And so when it appeared that it was available, we dug in and did some due diligence and believed in the promise and idea of this, simply right. this is yes. an idea. What if America's only 100% employee-owned casino company owned the largest charity casino in America? Mm-hmm. That flywheel to yeah. us was so unique and so attractive. And the land and location was also very good that we really made a commitment and we yeah. jumped in and decided to diversify the company there.
Right. So for those who don't know, Seabrook Park was a historic racetrack in New yeah. Hampshire. I mean, it was, yeah. as you mentioned, it's a place where you'd bring your kids and you'd have, yeah. have a great day at the racetrack. I mean, I don't know if they yeah. do that anymore, but that yeah. was that. So what did you
those
have to
Those are bygone
do?
Days. Those are bygone days.
Right,
for sure.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So what did you have to do when you got there in terms of building a facility?
Well, I will tell you, and we laugh about this, but it's true. When we it was a big old building, mm-hmm. you know, racetrack buildings, so,
right.
and the track was still there, although it looked much more like a park
right.
And a forest land mm-hmm. now. It was raining on the inside of the building. It was kind of famous for that.
Yeah,
the
right.
roof had been so bad for so long. So we had a lot of work ahead of us to make it a regional destination and attraction. And we also needed some legislation to advance. And right. the first piece of legislation we were able to advance was sports betting. And we got that legalized in 2019. And we're set to open the sports book with DraftKings. Mm-hmm. Actually, days before the closure
yeah.
In 2020 because of the pandemic. That following year, we were able to go back to work. And you know, really, a lot of people don't know, the state of New Hampshire is the second largest democratic body in the world,
right.
Second only to the parliament in India. Mm-hmm. But we got to work with a lot of great people.
Wow.
We were able to rally state, around a common cause.
Yeah.
We passed legislation to allow historical horse racing machines. Mm-hmm. And those have been showing up in a few jurisdictions across right. the country, Virginia, Kentucky. Of course, they've been in the West for a while before that. So we got that done and we onboarded those games in 2021. And then we set out to diversify and build what we in Nevada would say is a kind of a both a neighborhood and regional casino, mm-hmm. both.
Yeah.
And so we added things like restaurants, showrooms, outdoor dining. We built a very large sports book because New Englanders, of course, like their sports, and like sure, their home right. teams. And now we have a 90,000 square foot casino with a grand ballroom, and we've got another restaurant under construction currently. We're working on the exteriors, working on a residential and multifamily project on the site. Hmm. And so, you know, it's becoming to in its final form something that, you know, probably anyone from Southern Nevada would probably arrive at, quickly understand what it is.
Right.
But it's done in a uniquely New England way.
Right.
So the Brook has all the personality of its New Hampshire roots.
Great, great. So tell us how gaming works in terms of the regulations and taxes and things of that nature.
Yeah. So in New Hampshire, it's overseen by the Lottery Commission, mm-hmm. Capably by the Lottery Commission, I'd add. And there's a few different constructs. So the casino games, side table games, live games, run under a charity casino construct,
right.
where 35% of all revenue is donated to two charities every day. So charities are come forward, they're screened by both the property and then by the Attorney General's office. To get gaming dates. They can have up to 10 dates a year.
Okay.
And then the casino companies themselves engage with two charities every day. They get, those charities then receive 35% of the win each day.
Okay.
On table games. And then they receive 35% of the state's 25%. For historical horse racing machines.
Okay.
So currently that means that a charity at the Brook with about a 7-day charity run, there'll be two charities every 7 days, is receiving between $98,000 and $120,000.
Okay.
So this is real money
for
everyone from Make-A-Wish to Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very efficient way to fundraise.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a really efficient way to build awareness for organizations. When you have that many, 105 or so charities that you're working on behalf of, look, some of them doing great work, provide great services, and people don't know they exist.
Yeah.
And so when they need them, they don't know they're out there. And so the Brook really gives them a platform as well to help people to know they're out there and what they provide.
Okay. So when it's their day, do they have tables set up with brochures and things like that?
They can do that. They can also have, some of them will have events on property to give thank yous to volunteers, to call for volunteers. They'll kind of spin off their annual gala on those dates mm-hmm. so that when the people exit the event, they're also gaming on behalf of the charity.
Yeah.
So the example I give is Make-A-Wish, for instance, has Kentucky Derby Week.
Right.
You know, we're still a really big destination for race betting. And so they do an Oaks party
mm-hmm.
the night before the Derby and
kind
of have people come in their hats and regalia. It's great connectivity between the two. And we've now raised over $200,000 for Make-A-Wish, you know, and so that's, you know, over 20 wishes since we started in 2019.
Great. So HHR machines are a little unique. I got to play them in Virginia when I visited Colonial Downs and my friend Aaron Gomes, who ran that at the time. And, you know, if you don't know, you know, it's just like a slot machine. Do you get anybody questioning, you know, what's going on with this game?
I think, you know, it's funny. If you had asked me before all this started, would horse bettors bet would they play HHR machines? I probably would have said no.
Yeah.
But that turned out not to be the case.
Hmm.
Because, of course, one of the things that's different about an HHR machine is you can manually handicap it.
Right.
And And you get this kind of instant outcome, right?
Yeah.
For your handicapping, which is, you know, can be kind of pretty gratifying. So I think that feature makes it unique.
Right.
And those players, it brought those players to the game.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of been fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, you have the little horse racing image in the corner. Some
icon running the race. Yeah.
So I thought it was very interesting, but certainly you get real slot players who just don't really care how it's determined, and they just take their win or losses one way or the other.
And I would say that evolution came in large part to more of the Class 3 manufacturers bringing their cabinets and themes to HHR.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have, you know, pretty much title for title, whether you're on a Class 3 floor or you're on an HHR floor, you're going to see the same titles.
Right, right. Okay. And so the table games then are operated like a charity casino. I know years ago when Connecticut was involved with the tribes down there, they used that as their entry into casino gaming, because Connecticut allowed charity casinos. I guess that's the same thing in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and the growth of it has been, you know, been well managed, and oversight's been provided by the Lottery Commission, and of course it's been pretty clear that now it's kind of grown yet again, and so the infrastructure to support it and regulate it at the state level has happened simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I'd say is, you know, this is a part of the country where, you know, the Boston area really, which is our regional market, you know, we're about 45 minutes from the center of city, from Logan Airport, so to speak. They love their table games.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is still a part of America where people like to play poker, people like to play blackjack, people really like roulette. And so these are busy pits.
Okay.
And it's real play.
So how many table games do you have? How many HHRs do you have?
Yeah, so HHR, we're up around 500 currently. And table games, we have 20 poker tables, and 18 tables, and then we have an additional sizable fusion or dealer-assisted gaming area that gives you almost another 34 positions.
I see. Okay, great. So Boston is a pretty competitive gaming market right now with the two casinos, or the one casino in Boston, and then you have on the Rhode Island side, you've got the Twin Creek casinos. How do you compete against those, you know, quote unquote, real casinos?
Yeah, I mean, I think
is the
answer to the question. I think we did need to advance the product. The product quality had to get better. We've done that at the Brook. We've made the investment necessary so that in look and feel, and we're blessed with incredibly good leadership on property, incredibly good employee owners on property who are talented long-term professionals in the industry. Their experience competes.
Yeah.
Right, plain and simple, it's got to compete with Encore.
Sure, right.
And given my history, I like to think I understand what it takes to provide those kinds of experiences. And so, you know, I entered to bring to the market a product that competes.
Yeah.
When it comes to, you know, are we going to go out and build all the amenitized structure of the Encore? No.
Yeah.
But the majority, I think you and I both know, most gamers don't need all of that amenitized infrastructure.
Sure.
A few gamers do.
Right.
And so I focus on the core product offerings that gamblers want. You know, the game's got to be good. The service of the game's got to be good. The environment's got to be good. And food's got to be good.
Yeah.
And the beverage service got to be good.
Sure.
And I think we do that real well.
Yeah. Well, you know, having worked for Mirage, you know you know, the level of service they provide, and to their credit, even after Steve Wynn left, they've maintained that level of service. So you've got to train your employees. What kind of employees did you get there when you first started? I mean, were they experienced dealers, or were they, did you have to train them from ground up?
Yes. So interestingly, I was really fortunate. I was able to buy a nearby competitor, so I was able to keep a really good core group of long-term experienced dealers who had talent, who had history in Atlantic City and Nevada and for many years in New Hampshire. But then we also were able to open up a dealer school. And look, we've been improving our curriculum over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good now. And frankly, between you and I mean, we know like dealer-assisted games are a great way for people to get reps.
Sure.
Where you don't have to manage all of the payment side. It's a great way to get reps. So having those machines in place and giving people those extra reps at those games and allowing them to matriculate in advance into learning more games. We've been able to improve our process. I think our process continues to improve. But yes, we're running a dealer school there every month and getting great candidates. Getting great interest, thankfully.
Great.
Yeah.
And so again, you, with your experience at the Mirage, in the Mirage company, you understand that. So do you, are you able to communicate that to your new employees?
You know, I think our folks would probably say that they're tired of my Bobby Baldwin, Steve Wynn, and Mirage Resort stories.
Right?
But but in another way, look, I'm super grateful for all of that context and all of those years. And to Tillman Fertitta is another one during my time at Golden Nugget after the acquisition.
Right.
I mean, you just, these are, what you learn is these are special minds, these renegade entrepreneurs that are change agents to this degree. They've got a DNA that if you have the chance to get firsthand learning from it, it's wild how it stays with you in moments of need the rest of your life as a guide. And so I do think our folks at the Brook and in Mesquite have great context. You know, our mantra, it's up on brass plaques on the walls, is the St. Jerome's prayer. Good, better, best, never let it rest till our good is better and our better is best. And so any product where we bring to market, we're trying to be the best in the market we compete in. And that means that you got to continually improve. You got to continually commit to getting better. And I think our folks embrace that.
Yeah.
I do. And
no
so,
question.
You know, if you had a bad experience today, keep up hope, because as a customer, know that we're out there trying to find our blind spots and get better.
Right. So are you kind of a hands-on manager? I mean, when I was a dealer at the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City, I was a baccarat dealer, and we were sitting on a dead game, and Steve Wynn would walk in the pit and sit down at the game and talk to us, all us lowly dealers, you know. Are you that kind of hands-on employer?
Look, I just said yesterday. We're in training for our leadership training group, our kind of rising stars in the company. And I said the most difficult thing for me to reacclimate to is how now having two properties on either side of the country, how it gets a little bit harder to just kind of live on the floor. You know, I think it's safe to say, you know, for a lot of my Golden Nugget years, I just really lived on the floor. And then I could take a few meetings. And I think, you know, Zoom and remote work and the amount of people you have that are in consultancy and not employees over time and time zones. It makes it harder to live on the floor. Now, does it mean that that's not my first love? No. That is my first love. I mean, I'd rather be in it, in every part of it, every day. I'd rather be on the line and in the expo window and taking tickets at the door of the theater. It's just much more natural to me. I think I have an accountability to my folks, particularly as employee owners, to grow the business for them and use my time in a way that's most accretive to them.
Right.
And sometimes that's not me, you know, sitting on the floor with them or sure. standing on the
right.
floor with them.
Right.
And so that's a hard adjustment. I don't know. Talk to me in 10 more years, see if I'm any more comfortable with it. But
right.
I think I only get less comfortable with it over time.
Right. Well, it's kind of a strange situation. My next question was going to how does it affect that the employers are the owners of the company? So in some sense, they're your boss as much as you're their boss.
Yeah, look, I certainly view this in such a way that the work that we do is done on behalf of the employee owners,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, when you're reinvesting in the business, or in the case of the Brook, you know, making a new investment,
right.
In order to grow the business, you're doing it on their behalf.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the one hand, look, I've had public companies, I've worked in private family businesses, I've had all those different constructs. I will say emotionally, this one's very different.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, when I walk in to give everybody in our kind of annual meeting, our state of the business, our share price for the year, I feel very different than when I'm on an earnings call.
Right.
you know, bringing them good news, or in the case of 2020,
yeah.
Kind of that year, you know, bringing them difficult news
yeah.
Is much more emotional
yeah.
than any earnings call or bond rating I have ever
sure.
participated
right.
in.
Right, no question about that.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, yeah. So do you see the model in New Hampshire of the charity gaming being adopted in other states?
I'd really like to think so.
Well, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, I do. I do, because, I mean, look, if we step back for just a little bit of a second and we look at kind of moods,
right.
there is moods in this country about how much government does.
Right.
And how much government there is,
mm-hmm.
okay? And when you look at social causes, social needs, educational needs, civic service needs, there's a point where, okay, there is no government function. That is the realm
sure.
of charity. So mm-hmm. 501c3s, right? Somebody's got to do that work. And so this becomes essential work in some areas, right? You know, when I look at what Meals on Wheels does, you know, we have still 10% of American seniors have food scarcity.
Right.
Right. So it's not a like to have, it's a need to have
yeah.
for some people, right?
Sure.
And so funding Meals on Wheels to make sure the people in a region who have food scarcity get those meals is a need to have. And where gaming has, you know, pretty consistently been used is to grow tax base.
Right.
Sometimes single purpose, we're going to do this for education, you know, it's pretty common. This makes it a really tactical tool
yep.
to address some of the most urgent needs of a specific community
sure.
at a specific time.
Yeah.
So I'd love to say I'd be part of any discussion
yeah.
on kind of redirecting tax to charity
mm-hmm.
or standing up new jurisdictions around charity.
Right.
I think about Hawaii right now, and I'm not trying to open a casino in Hawaii,
yeah.
but there's a great example of where, okay, it's time to turn these time, talent, and treasure towards addressing this urgent need that mm-hmm. we have in Maui.
Right, yeah.
It's a powerful tool.
Yeah, no question about that. And, you know, you've given millions of dollars to charity through your operation so far, right?
Yeah, so since 2019, we have given away, now we're coming up on $20 million
yeah.
To charity.
Yeah.
And so if and I say this, and it's kind of like you and I can do this in a moment, whoever's watching, we'll see if it resonates
right.
with them. But I remember when it was a big deal when Ben and Jerry says, we're going to give 1% for peace. You know, like,
yeah.
and I was like, oh man, that's incredible. I eat this ice cream. I feel so much better about eating this ice cream right now because they're going to get 1% of what
right.
I spend on this ice cream so that we can live in a more peaceful world.
Right.
I mean, we're giving 35 cents on every dollar to an essential charity.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to provide services for drug addiction.
Sure.
It's going to, for people who have traumatic brain injuries, it's going to, agencies that help with affordable housing. It's going to work.
Right.
every day, 35 cents on every dollar. Mm-hmm. That's different than almost any other enterprise there is.
Right.
And with the resulting remaining profitability of the business, it's providing a long-term retirement benefit for hospitality workers, mm-hmm. some of the most underpaid, underprepared
right.
part of the workforce when it comes to retiring.
Right. Yeah.
And so if we can make it work and we can actually make it thrive, one of the things we say at our company is, the Eureka vision is to show that people and profits cannot just coexist
yeah.
together, but they can thrive.
Yeah, no question.
And if we can thrive, and we are, mm-hmm. I do kind of want to see other people maybe look at our business model and try to do it in our industry and others.
Sure. Well, that's a pretty inspiring story, Andre. So what's next for Eureka? I mean, are you looking for other states now? Obviously, you're still trying to diversify the company.
Without question. So anybody's watching this and is excited about, and I say this to people who own resorts, hotels, restaurants, casinos. Mm-hmm. If you don't quite know how you're going to exit, employee ownership is right. a real pathway to that. Mm-hmm. If you want to know and understand what that could mean, please reach out to me. If you want to benefit and learn about our business model or think you could apply it and we can help you apply it to your business, please reach out to me, because the kind of our story is the way we'll grow.
Right.
Is if you're looking for a different way, the Eureka way may be it. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we'll continue to grow. That is my obligation and my passion for the people that I'm able to work with every day who own our business. And we will not just stay in this industry.
Right.
We'll diversify industry and continue to diversify geography as well. I love the gaming industry. I love restaurant business. I love the hotel business. I love putting on great shows for people. But I also love making sure our folks have great health care. I also love making sure our people have a great and affordable place to live. And so those are all paths and tributaries that we'll continue to explore and others.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the time, Andre. It's great catching up with you. We're going to keep an eye on the company for the next few years and see where you're going, because I think you were one of our people to watch a few years ago, and you certainly have proven that you're capable of that. So, again, thank you for the time.
Hey, no, thank you for the time and for giving us a little bit of attention today. I'm always grateful.
Absolutely.
All the best.
Okay, we'll talk to you. Hope you enjoyed today's GGB podcast, sponsored by Pavilion Payments. Learn more about the full suite of gaming solutions available at pavilionpayments.com. To learn more about the topics discussed today and all the important issues in gaming, check out Global Gaming Business Magazine. For a free virtual copy of the magazine, subscribe at ggbmagazine.com. To stay current with the weekly news of the gaming industry, subscribe to ggbnews.com. Use the coupon code GGB180 for a free subscription. And don't miss a single episode of the GGB podcast. Subscribe on Amazon, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts today. And we'll see you next time on the GGB podcast. You tore me apart.